Good morning and welcome to Sport and Life with Sam Kekovich and Leon Weigard. Sam, how's your week?
Well, Leon, I got to tell you, I got an extra special bounce in me today, and all week I have.
Oh.
Since our little sojourn to the country last Sunday, to watch one of our equine steeds strut his wares over the jumps. The horse in question, of course, that you and I and the people on his backside, called Stern Idol, which won so impressively, which is now heading to the Bool for that time-honoured meeting at Warrnambool in May, in the Briley.
Well, in this case, April.
It is, exactly. Tuesday, April, the last day of April, I think it is, the last day. So it was exciting to see it.
Wasn't it
stuff. It was fantastic.
Had Jerry Ryan, the major shareholder out there. And
Jerry was with us. John Rebo, of course, Desi Kelly, the Irishman was there. And, of course, none other than our spiritual leader, Neil Grant, Acker Lumpy.
Yes.
And also Peter Blunden, for God's sake.
Yes.
Editor-in-chief of the Herald Sun.
From the Herald Sun, yep.
So it was exciting times, and we look forward to it in great anticipation with a great deal of optimism that we may, on our return journey in the, well, we're heading over in a jet to Warrnambool, which it takes about 3 minutes to get there. But upon our return,
I'll tell you what, if it takes 3 minutes, I'd be worried about the landing.
Well, you spend more time on the tarmac in those jets than you do actually in the air to Warrnambool. It's a hop, step and a jump. Well, when I say 3 minutes, that was just a throwaway line.
3 minutes would have us crashing about North Geelong.
Oh, don't be talking like that, you know. We go to Terminal and 30. But anyhow, it was exciting and fun news.
It was so, yeah.
So the sport of kings, and I thought it was appropriate today, Leon, as you rightfully alluded to, you know, given the fact that we're involved in that volatile investment portfolio called the punt, and it is that racing everyone's on the tip of their tongue is Warrnambool, we thought it might be appropriate to talk to someone who's really made an impact.
Well, last Tuesday in the paper, an article in the Herald Sun by Brad Waters was about the mini comeback of Brent Thompson, who you know well, and I used to know reasonably well.
The babe.
Well, he's from New Zealand originally. He won four Cox plates, rode some of the great horses, rode in the great centres of racing around the world. And is on the line
Hall
now.
Hall of Famer.
Brent, big comeback, and congratulations on that. You dropped a lot of weight to do this.
Well, firstly, good morning to you both. Sam, I didn't think you needed an excuse to be at Warrnambool ever without using a racehorse as an excuse to go there. And the names that you dropped along the way, it's like the who's who of racing.
Yeah, so
business.
Warrnambool have been warned and they've actually faced an extra wine order. They've got another truckload going down.
Not to mention three booze buses at the quarter.
It sounds good, and you know, what other way would you go but a private jet? There's no, yeah. You know, it takes too long to drive.
The great Brent Thompson, by gee, didn't he make an impact? 16-year-old kid from Wanganui. It was always in your blood, was it, Brent? I think your old man was a trainer, wasn't he, not?
Yeah, he was. Sam, he also, he was a jockey well before me, but had some weight issues, and that forced him to ride over fences, and he did that, got injured, and that was sort of, I was a kid then. But he actually did actually train two Grand Nationals here in Melbourne along the way with a horse called Somoy. So he always had a jumper or two and was successful in training those equally on the flat.
Now, you're the leading jockey in New Zealand as an apprentice, I think.
Yeah, I was sort of outrode my claim at a very quick notice, and I was riding against the older jockeys, you know, from the age of about 15, and I don't know. It's hard to pump up your own tyres, but it sort of all went at quite a rate, and you know, then I got that opportunity to come to Australia to ride Fury's Order in the 1975 Cox Plate. And that sort of all went quite fast beyond that.
I'll never forget that Cox Plate because it was a torrential downpour of biblical proportions. Remember that? It was a horror stretch, wasn't it? Yeah, they talk about the rain. The rain that eventuated when what's the name? One Kiwi won that.
Vanderham.
But that rain of Fury's order, that how they ever ran that race is beyond beyond comprehension.
It was horrendous conditions. There's no question. It was actually wasn't unsimilar to the conditions of Vanderham's Cup that year, really. Like they all come and the rains that fell that day virtually came half an hour before the race.
That's right. Tell me, Brent.
I'd imagine you would have been on the football field that day, Sam.
Oh, yeah, I managed to sneak out just for a little flutter because I knew you were across there. I knew it was a moral with you on board. Tell me, babe, what was the reason? What lured you across the Great Ditch? I know C.S. Hayes was the man, but how did he manage to entice you to come over with a... How big was the paper bag?
I guess by the time I'd been here for three separate carnivals, I obviously had the aspirations to settle in Australia and ride, and so to get that offer of that. What was probably one of four jobs, major jobs in Australia, to get
the prize one. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it was a prize job, wasn't it? It was one
Yeah, absolutely. So it was very didn't need much to think about it or much time to think about it. It was all pretty hastily organised, and it opened up. Enormous opportunities to me to be associated with that stable, of course.
You must have had some natural talent, Brent, apart from the fact you, as you said, you got a bit of a lead in with your father, but it must have come naturally to you.
Yes, I generally think, I don't know, in terms of other sports people, but I think that jockeys are not made. They normally, have some natural ability or, very much, I think, you're great sports people, it becomes instinctive to them. I guess I was lucky enough to be born with that and was able to, utilise it to pretty big heights.
Let's get back to basics while you're still in New Zealand. Sam mentioned you were from Whanganui.
Yes.
So let's get the location organised. Where's that?
In the North Island. It's sort of more the central part of... racing there is made up of what's called the central districts, the Waikato region and the northern region, and of course, let's not forget about the South Island. My career was commenced in the central districts of New Zealand racing. For those that are not totally familiar with it, Matt, but probably more central point that people would remember is Palmerston North. So that was the area that I grew up and rode, and Taranaki is very much part of that too. So it's sort of like you growing up riding in pony club shows into hunting in the winter, and which is obviously a great background to a career.
God, the number of New Zealand jockeys that have made a career here in Australia is amazing.
Yes, well, from a small country's point of view, in terms of sports people, they've always probably batted outside their, the size of the country, because, historically it's had some great sports people, and as we know, many good New Zealand jockeys relocated to Australia and all different states of Australia and were successful. I was fortunate to have a big job with a Colin Hayes stable was obviously enormous help too, because the spin-off of that led me to my association with Robert Sangster, and then, you know, alternative, I went to Europe and rode there for what, in the mid-'80s and mid-'90s, seven seasons. So, it was quite a huge part of my riding career, really.
It's interesting, isn't it, you mentioned about the sporting prowess of New Zealand. You know, I follow very closely. I remember the days of Peter Snell, the great miler, All Blacks. You talk about the All Blacks, you talk about their cricket side, you talk about every facet of their sporting dynamic has always been, world class.
The yachting.
Yachting was big. Women's netball team.
Quite amazing when you think of a population probably less than 4 million people.
Exactly. You know, why is it that they punch above their weights, babe?
I don't know. It's a difficult one for me to ask answer. I haven't given. I have my limitations, Sam, of course, and I haven't given much thought to that one.
Yeah, it must be something in the air there. Now, babe, you mentioned your international prowess, and you did ride a lot in the UK, but yes. You also rode in a place called Macau. Now, Macau racing was very big at the time too.
Yeah, it was right at the end of my career, it was still going very strong then. You might be aware that it just closed the other day, which is quite sad, and so will Singapore during this year.
Why'd they close Kranji now? I mean, Singapore's a fairly democratic nation.
Yeah, look, I think it's never been strongly supported by government, as I understand it. Even in its heyday, if you flew into Singapore and opened the back of the Straits Times, you'd hardly notice that there was a race meeting on.
Yeah.
But you know, they raced for over 150 years, which is extremely sad.
That's
that
what
it
I mean.
Should, disappear now. Of course, you know, Australia and New Zealand and other countries fed a lot of horses into that place over the years. In terms of, you know, they probably had at any given time 1,000 plus horses racing at any given time. So. It is sad, and they had, it was a beautiful race course. Even Booker Tima before it was a beautiful race course. Macau, I think, was mainly badly managed, it was its own demise, unfortunately.
Well, I was in Macau with Jeff Lane, actually, when he was training over there, Brent, and... There was a bit of a conflict there. I think the guy that owned the casino also owned the racetrack. So, a very wealthy guy. And, I mean, people were always suspicious that he was more interested in the poker machines than he was in the racing.
To be transparent to you.
But for whatever reason, it looked a bit down in the mouth when I was there, I must say. And that was, I guess, in the late 90s.
Because Stanley Ho has since passed on, and he was probably still alive when you're talking about Jeff Lane being there. So he was the main patron of the racing there, but obviously casinos now, like, I wouldn't even know the place. I haven't been back there for a number of years, guys, and so many casinos got built, and I think obviously it's a very small enclave, and it's got more limitations of land than Hong Kong has, and I guess that piece of land that it was on was more valuable to the government than it was to have a race course on it. Unfortunately, it's off the radar screen now, and actually has a knock-on effect for lots of reasons, because from sales companies' point of view, like Australia and New Zealand, you know, it's always Asia. It was always the supply of horses normally came from Australasia to those countries, because mostly those horses sort of worked in that region better than others. And so, you know, all of a sudden there's a huge hole in the marketplace where we haven't got those two countries buying horses.
Okay, getting back to Brent Thompson himself, in this article in the Herald Sun during the week, it says that you put a bit of weight on, and that was pretty evident the last time I saw you at the Carbine Club or somewhere. But you've dropped all that and you've been going to Keyser.
Yes, well, I don't know that I've dropped an enormous amount of weight, but I have gone to Keyser for quite some time. I can't remember when I actually commenced going there, but I it suited program suited my, you know, certain injuries that I sustained when I was riding. And anyway, by they do a program that might suit, you know, like athletes or sports people, any existing injuries, older injuries that that we have, and build a program around that. So I've been doing that for some time. All that time, I never ever considered getting on a horse. But it came as no surprise when I did actually ride a horse that I didn't hurt that badly, because a lot of those, well, a number of those machines that I worked on sort of gave me the impression that, you know, a lot of those muscles are the muscles that you'd certainly use as in my riding day. So, and it's all about strength and core. And so I don't know, that lost a lot of weight, but I've certainly built big strength, and I feel pretty good with it. And I even feel better now that I'm back riding, to be honest.
Babe, most people at 66 would be either buying a caravan drifting off into the sunset. But you've decided to hop back in the saddle. Why would you want to do that instead of enjoying the Fridays and Saturdays of your life?
I think your ego must have got in the way somewhere, Sam. I don't know. Maybe I thought I might have been wasting some talent.
Exactly.
Tug in cheek. Well, I guess I got to a sort of certain level. I thought I was pretty fit. I think in that very article that you mentioned, I mentioned the fact that I, and you're aware of it anyway, that I hadn't had a picked up a glass of red for
17 months.
Any form of that for 17 months. And I think that somewhat inspired me to get back on the horse, as it were.
Tell me, the C.S. Hayes contract would have been a lot of pressure on you. When you arrived, did you feel the enormity of the pressure and the need to succeed? And what did C.S. Hayes like about you to offer you the huge deal?
I guess, you know, because I'd been there to the Spring Carnival, that was the third time I'd been to Australia, and I'd met with, you know, a fair bit of success. And I'd ridden Family of Man in that Cox Plate in the spring that led him to ask me to ride for him in January the following year. And I guess that success at an early age must have impressed him. I think that the end of the association with himself and Johnny Stocker was you know, at its end, and he was looking for a replacement. I just happened to be that person. But yes, there certainly was plenty of pressure that early part of it, because you know, obviously I was desperate to succeed. But you know, all of a sudden it's like being thrown in the deep end. Like coming over for the spring was one thing. You could always toddle off back home with your tail between your legs if it didn't work out. But pick up the one of the, you know, three or four prime jobs in Australian racing, obviously that came with its pressure. The first two or three city meetings that I rode, and I can remember, you know, riding a number of favourites that failed, and and I certainly felt some pressure. Keep in mind, I was still only 19 years old then, but I do remember it was a midweek meeting at Flemington. It all turned around. I think I treble for the day, and it sort of then just sort of took off and went quite smoothly after that. But yeah, it didn't come without its pressure. You're quite right.
You won 6 premierships with the C.S. Hayes stable. Did you win a premiership in your first year?
No, I don't recall who rode
Roy year. Would have probably. Roy was Roy. There. Roy Higgins.
It could well have been him still. There was the era where Harry White, Roy Higgins, Gary Willits. So there was plenty of very good, great jockeys. I think the following year I might have. Won my first premiership.
How was your rapport with the jockeys in the jockey room when you arrived there as C.S. Hayes number one rider? How were you looked upon by the big boys, and how was the level of acceptance?
The level of acceptance was fine because, you know, I had been successful in those, you know, previous springs that I came over for. So I suppose it wasn't like sort of just, you know, bringing your get into the jocks room and announcing your arrival. But it was interesting that the general public on those early days that I wasn't successful, they were giving me a bit of flack there, telling me where I should be living, which wasn't in Australia. And but because I was taking the job of an Australian. And but again, that sort of just turned around once I proved successful. It all unfolded, and I was accepted by racing public.
You're on Sport and Life, and our guest is Brent Thompson. Brent, four Cox plates. What's the trick about winning a Cox plate? Or is there no trick? It's a matter of what horse that you're on and the way you ride it on the day.
I think the Valley has its ways, and I think I worked that out. I think I rode the Valley very well, and but of course in a big race such as the Cox Plate, you've got to be on one of the leading chances. Generally, it's assumed the best horse, the best weight for age. Horse of that year will probably win the race. If you go back to Fury's Order, as Sam alluded to, that extremely wet track, it was a bit of a war of attrition as far as I was concerned, because the distance between the first and second horse I think was a fair margin, and it was just a bit of a hard slog and survival of the fittest. The following year, Surround, you will remember her, both remember her, she was outstanding. Peter Cook rode her.
Jeff Murphy.
For Jeff Murphy, Family and Man, well, he was a wonderful weight for age horse, and he beat Raffendale. But, you know, all of those races, you know, I can remember I didn't have any bad luck in them or made my own luck in them, I think. Barrier draws, yes, are of an importance. But one thing about the Valley, from that start, the 2,000-metre start, you cannot be 3 and 4 wide around that first corner because you'll just get posted out wide. The entire trip, and I guess I just always made that a priority that wouldn't happen, from about the 800 metre part of the race it all unfolds, but the importance was probably that first three corners really that if you were out wide would put paid to your chances.
Now, I noticed among the great horses you rode, one was Strawberry Road, which is owned by John Sinclair, Singleton, of course.
Singleton,
I don't know whether you knew him very well personally, but The great tragedy, of course, about his daughter being involved with that Bondi Junction matter. So commiserations to John Singleton and all those involved.
Yes.
So you're going back into training, you're doing track work. Do you find getting up in the morning a bit of a wretch? Or
I remain a creature of habit, really, so nothing's really changed. I tend to wake up at 5 o'clock with or without the alarm. Of course, not having a drink probably helps that too. One's sleep pattern's way, way better. But need the aid of the alarm if I'm going to Fingal, because that's about an hour and a half drive, Leon, and... I've got to get up, well before 5 o'clock to head down there. I don't know how I'll go over the depths of winter. Maybe I might check in with Kieran if he needs me in Queensland. That might be a bit way better result. Take the golf clubs up there, and the early morning up there might not be, well, it won't be as cold, that's for sure.
Babe, I think it was a time, I think you were fairly well conditioned. I think if my memory serves me correctly, not so long ago, it was a time when you and I'd be getting home about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes,
and we'd venture off straight to the track.
More times than most, I think.
We'd have to worry about an alarm clock. But you certainly rode some of the great horses. Dulcify comes to mind. Gee, what a superstar horse he was. Think you rode some of the almighty great horses of the turf, didn't you?
I did actually. Leon mentioned Strawberry Road. He was quite incredible, really. He, if you go back, obviously we all think of the great tragedy with John Singleton's daughter and Kerry Good's daughters both being killed in that.
Shocking.
John bought into Strawberry Road before or when he went to Europe, and when I rode him in Germany. He actually raced in different colours. He raced in the boxing kangaroo. So he had, green and yellow. It had a red cap, and it had a boxing kangaroo body of the colours. So he won on those. John definitely wasn't there on the day. And then he was later sold he was sold twice. He was sold to one of the big French stables, and then the Wildenstein family bought him. Alec Wildenstein bought him. Then when he went to America, he was sold again, and he raced in the Breeders' Cup over there, running second. So he was a bit of a amazing horse in terms that he raced in about four different continents and really held his own. But Dulcify was a standout in my career, without any question. He's always talked about when it comes around Cox Plate time and of course sadly Melbourne Cup time, because that's when he lost his life. But I rode lots of other good horses, both here and overseas.
Indeed you did. Tell me, babe, just quickly, having a great contract with the leading stables is fantastic. It gives you a lot of assurance, a lot of guarantees. But it can also be a pain in the butt. And the reason I'm saying that is because you've ridden all the winners in all the great races of the world, but you've denied one great victory, and that was the Melbourne Cup. And the only thing that got in your way, of course, was that contractual arrangement you had with the Hayes family. Otherwise, you would have ridden Gurner's Lane. Is that right?
Correct, yes. Yeah, well, I rode him in the Caulfield Cup. And,
exactly.
We didn't have a runner in the Caulfield Cup, but one horse qualified in the Moonee Valley Cup, and because of my
contract
with the stable, I had to ride Triumphal March in the Melbourne Cup, so I missed out on a Melbourne Cup winning ride. Of course, I had to ride it as well as Mick Tipman, but
it should never have won the race, of course.
Yes.
Kingston Town should have absolutely bolted in.
Yeah, well, it's one of those races.
One of those races.
Talked about whether Malcolm went too soon.
Too early, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's sort of one of those great moments in sport where people voice their opinions on a ride. You know, the Miller's Guide will still read Gurner's Lane as the winner.
You're dead right.
It eluded me, and you know, I'm sure Dulcify. I know Dulcify would have won it. I ran third on Kythera to Vanderham, you know, she could.
She could
heavy tracks, but she couldn't quite swim. And she ran a blinding third that day. I think I ran another third. Might have been Mappily Heights. It was just one of those races that just eluded me. But I don't.
Don't lose any sleep over it, mate.
Now, we're talking to Brent Thompson. For anyone that's confused, it's not Babe Ruth. Where did this Babe come from?
Babe came from Keith Hillier came to do a story on me before I came to Australia to ride Fury's Order. And he led off with the headline, calling me the Babe, and it stuck over all those years, Leon.
Good old Keith,
rightly or wrongly, I still wear it.
Well, you look like, you know, you look 16-year-old kid, you look like a baby, really. You had that baby look about you, but little did they realise you had the heartbeat of an assassin when you were on that saddle in the pigskin. Now, tell me, jockeys are renowned for having the odd flutter every now and again, and, of course, the sport of kings is inundated with the stories of colourful people.
Yes.
And, of course, people like you would be targeted, I guess, riding the favourites or the, for the prime stable. You would have been offered a number of inducements or would have been tried to be coerced into some nefarious little arrangements. You care to share a couple of those?
Look, I'll put it this way. There's so many innuendos made of that. I think what might have gone on those, back a number of years ago, there was a few inducements offered, but I prided myself on a serious note, guys. I prided myself on
keeping yourself straight.
And you know, I guess. You either do or you don't. I'm not trying to sound like a absolute clean skin, but I prided myself on what that big word we use today, integrity. Never really tumbled into that to that sort of stuff.
You didn't need to, mate.
I'm not suggesting I didn't. Have something on something that I liked myself that I was riding, but at the end of the day, if I was ever offered to do something wrong, I refused to fall into it. And you hear all sorts of things these days. I think. A lot of that doesn't exist because prize money levels are so high that the whole business has changed. There's so much money on offer for
exactly.
To win it all. Not to win at all costs, but to be successful.
Now, Brent, you mentioned before about going to Keyser with all your injuries and from the past falls and all the sorts of stuff you can do while being a jockey. Is that the main reason why you'd think about retiring? Why do most jockeys give it away?
Good question. In my case, Leon, when I was living in Macau, I wasn't enjoying living there. And I always made a point of... saying to myself, the day I stopped really enjoying it, that means I'm not going to do it well. That means I don't do it. And so I made up my decision to stop riding very quickly, like there in Macau, there was no, you know, journalists in terms of what we have or, you know, had here. And so there was no big sort of fanfare or hoo-ha that I was riding. I just told a great mate of mine at the time. I said, this is the last day I'm going around. So I made no announcement, only told a mate of mine. And as soon as that meeting was over, I announced my retirement. But yeah, I could have come back to Australia and tried to pick up the pieces, but it's extremely hard to ever do that, because in my case, certainly, I'd been away for a long, long time. I'd spent more time out of Australia than in it, so you lose all your contacts, and they've moved on. There's always a young gun coming through. So to pick up the pieces, I guess I wasn't going to go be riding on a Saturday meeting in the provincials or whatever. And plus I was friends of the likes of David Hayes, Lee Friedman, all those guys at the time. And, it's not a case of calling in markers and saying, here, I'm back. What about me? So it seems much simpler to retire. Given that, I didn't have a B plan, but it wasn't based on injuries. It was just based on not enjoying what I was doing and not enjoying where I was living. That was the bottom line of it.
Well, Brent, you can rest assured, and I'm sure I speak on everyone associated with the game in Australia or around the world, that the name Brent Thompson will always remain synonymous with the great code of racing. You're certainly one of the all-time greats. You'll remain one of the all-time greats. And more importantly, you'll remain one of the all-time great guys. So whatever you want to do in the future, you can rest assured it will be with everyone's blessing. And we'd love to see you succeed again in the pigskin. And Leon...
This is a challenge for you. I've been thinking about this. What's now, that? Normally, Brent, we give, we offer.
I was going to get to
we
that.
We offer a couple of bottles of Michelin wine, but seeing you've been off the juice for 17 months, we have perhaps a couple of bottles of lemonade or Boone Spa or
dinner at the Prince.
What about I let both of you guys consume my share of it? I said to Jerry some time ago that I thought, you know, Zero wine was going to be quite popular, and I was a little ahead of my time, and now it is.
Yes.
Well, you can rest assured, babe, there's no zero wine consumed here. It'd be at the top of the food chain up here. But I'd realise you're offered, and I wasn't even going to mention it or offer it. Leon does, because he's in charge of distribution. We've had 300 people on this show over the last 3 or 4 years. And guess what? Not one of them's in receipt of their fare yet.
We have a lot of trouble with our dispatch department.
We've been sued from pillar to post.
There's no surprise either from this side of the microphone.
But, babe, I know you don't have a drink, but we'll certainly catch up for a meal very shortly.
Guys. Thank you for being asked to be on your podcast. I hope it went well.
You're a superstar.
Brent Thompson joining us there, and I was going to... leave space at the end to mention Kerry Good, an old North Melbourne band like you, and his daughter. But Brett was terrific in mentioning him too. Yeah. So commiserations to you, Kerry, and your family, and all those other people affected by that Bondi stabbing. Isn't it amazing where just one bloke being obviously radicalised by somebody and... it's awful. Anyway, we're not finishing on that note.
No, don't start me on that political sermon.
Guess who we're going to have next on this program? A gold medal winner.
Ooh.
Steve Hooker, the pole vaulter.
Wow.
Red-headed pole vaulter.
Steve. I do remember.
Good guy. So that's next week.
I love pole vaulting. I remember Sergei Bubka. Remember the
Sergei Bubka owned the world.
He owned the pole vaulting stick.
In fact, Sergei Bubka used to break the world record by an inch each time, because every time he broke a world record, he got a bonus. So he could have easily broken it by a foot.
And where would he collect? What, off Putin?
No, he was one of those...
Could you be collecting your bonus in
yeah. That's to stay alive.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever tried pole vaulting, Leon? No, seriously, I tried it once at Olympic Park when I was younger. Cool.
Impossible.
Oh, gee, but the sticks, I reckon, well, the pole vaulting sticks would have improved enormously over the period. I guess that would have, like every other sport, I guess technology would have caught up with that as well.
Well asked, Steve.
Flexibility of the stick.
You've been on Sport and Life with Sam Kekovich and Leon Wiegand.